Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
Hi, this is Dan Abuhab.
It's Sunday, May 21st, 2017, and this is Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.
And we just came back from a wedding.
A wedding in Kingston. Well, actually, the wedding wasn't in Kingston. We stayed in Kingston, New York.
Yeah.
The wedding was in Boyceville.
Okay.
At the Auntie Aura house.
Which was very nice.
It was exquisite. Exquisite.
Yes. Well, it was a beautiful view. Right.
It was a house built by Richard Hellman.
Oh, yeah.
The founder of Hellman's Mayonnaise.
Exactly.
Whose doctor told him when he was 50 that he had 6 months to live.
Right.
A little too much Hellman's.
A little too much Hellman's. But
unless he...
First thing he had to do to improve life was cut out the Hellman's. But beyond that, he said...
you've got to relax more, chill out. So he built this unbelievable house in New York State.
And it's beautiful.
And he lived to be 94.
That's right.
So there you have it.
Yeah.
We don't actually know if he stopped eating Hellman's. Maybe he ate more Hellman's. Maybe. But anyway, it was the wedding of my dear friend Nancy Ferguson's daughter, Sarah Ferguson, to Rajan Banerjee. And it was an exquisite wedding, exquisite view. And beautiful flowers, beautiful food, beautiful ceremony. So it was just a delight, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it was great.
And fun dancing, fun to see everybody, and to catch up after many, many, many years.
Yes, yeah, it was an idyllic wedding, to be sure. And we'll probably be back to upstate New York. I mean, there's a lot to see there. So, we had a cute breakfast place. We sort of wandered around a little bit.
Kingston's interesting. Yeah, Kingston is a small city,
yeah,
well past its heyday.
Mm.
Now it's got a new kind of heyday.
Yeah, coming back.
Yeah.
Like Rhinebeck, that sort of thing.
It's very Beacon, creative,
yeah,
kind of
artistic
old
vibe,
storefronts,
right,
have been translated into new fun restaurants, art centers, right, etc.
It has
a great waterfront.
Right. I mean, there's, all these cities, to the extent they come back, they go through an arc. They become popular. They become artist havens. The rent goes up. This is the beginning of that arc. The rent's not high yet.
I don't know if it's the beginning. It looks fairly established.
Mm, depends on the block.
But here's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of fun, interesting.
Oh yeah.
Restaurants.
Yeah.
Food.
Right.
Quite different from Central New Jersey. Okay. Why don't we have that?
This is the matter of
why
time.
Do we have to drive all the way to Kingston and Boyceville, down the road from Woodstock?
Okay, that's a fair point.
Beautiful.
Anyway,
beautiful,
it was a nice change. The other thing we did this week was we saw a play called The Antipodes at a theater we had never been to, called the Pershing Square Signature Theater, which is all the way west on 42nd Street.
There, so you're walking down 42nd Street.
Yeah.
And as you get way west,
yeah,
and we're talking west of 9th Avenue.
Yes, the Hudson.
There are all these theaters now.
Small theaters. And it's a very nice theater. So it's nice to discover that space. Apparently they have interesting plays once in a while.
Beautiful theater. Beautiful. You know what? Most beautiful theater restroom I have ever been in.
You were building the suspense on that.
It was sleek.
Yeah.
It was functional.
Yeah.
It was attractive.
Listen,
and there were a lot of stalls.
There's no question.
It is like the dream theater bathroom.
Right. And I there's no question.
Go there for the bathroom.
I take you to the finest places. So the Times review of Antipodes was this. The Times said that, and this is a play by Annie Baker. They say Annie Baker's in all ways fabulous new play about professional fabulators delivers a complete and confident narrative, leaves you glowing with a wondering satisfaction. And it goes on in what is a rave review. And here's what's interesting about it.
Well, I read this review.
Right.
That's why we went.
That's right. But here's
and fabulators are storytellers.
Right. But was interesting. Yes. Yes, we should say it was a sort of a set in a conference room where different folks were telling stories and they were trying to come up with some kind of creative work product, be it a video game or a play, you don't know. But the main point I have is, review notwithstanding, it was terrible. Okay? The play was terrible. And so now I say that with some hesitation, all right? we're not out to be overly critical of plays and artistic stuff. We understand that a lot is in the eye of the beholder. We understand people invest a lot of time and energy, their heart and soul in this. So we are as open-minded as we can possibly be in trying to see the value in this. But there was something wrong going on here. There was something wrong with this review.
It's the review. Great review. And of course, you know, I have egg all over my face.
No, because
I tricked Ian into going to this.
No, forget, that's not the point. The point is,
you know, recently, it didn't sound that compelling, people sitting around talking, but the review literally said, you know, you will be surprised.
All right, let me say one other thing. There are three reasons that we're confident saying that there's something really wrong about this review. And here they are. Number one is the review even goes into specifics, and it says things like, the Antipodes is also deeply funny. Okay, now let me hesitate for a moment. I'd be willing to concede we're not experts in terms of the theater, but I'd like to think I know funny to some degree. It wasn't funny. It wasn't deeply funny. It wasn't shallow funny. It wasn't medium-level funny. It wasn't funny. So I'm going, wow, that's just weird. Point two, the way the theater is set up, the Signature Theater is that you have audience on both sides of the stage. So you are staring at the other half of the audience. It's not a huge theater. So you're seeing 50% of the people there, whatever they are, a few hundred people, okay? They were dying. They were dying in the theater. I wasn't the only one dying. People were looking at the sheer shoes. They're looking at other people's shoes. They're wishing they had more and more interesting shoes. You know, it was brutal. People were dying.
Well, people did. There was laughter.
Now, there was a. You know what that laughter was?
What?
That laughter was, I'm here, I talked my husband into spending $150 a ticket, let's try to make something happen. Okay, it was people were trying to make a go of it. It was brutal. And point three is this, okay? Point three is, we go home and we're just talking on the way home, what's going on with this Times review?
Why do I keep getting tricked by these reviews?
So we go to the Wall Street Journal, and the Wall Street Journal clears it up. The Wall Street Journal says this. The play, its meaning is swaddled in thick layers of obscurantism that seem to exist to reassure the audience that something significant is happening on stage. Okay, we're going with a different direction in this review. It goes on. It says, like her previous plays, The Antipodes proceeds at a glacial pace that seems to grow slower and slower as the play goes on. The total effect is abusive of the attention span in a way that I find barely endurable. All right? How's that? How's that for a little bit of a different take on the situation? And so I'm going, how can this be? How can these two reviewers see the same play and come at it so differently? And as I go on in the review in the journal, the truth is revealed. The journal says, you know, what the play's really about, and now I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting, the play's really a sort of a reaction to the administration of Donald Trump. That it's, what they're really getting at is that there's no more valuable storytelling. We can't really delve into storytelling and enjoy it the way we did before because things have gone to heck in a handbasket. And they know this why, because they heard an interview with the author some months ago, and she made some allusion as to that's what the play is about. Now, that doesn't bother the Wall Street Journal, okay? But they make the point, and here's the quote, lest we forget, the mere fact that a play is anti-Trump doesn't make it good or bad, right? Nevertheless, it's pretty damned obvious that it's about Trump, not to mention tedious. And did he already say pretentious? If not, it's that too. What they're saying at the journal, obviously, is this. They're saying that some people are praising this play because they're sympathetic with the point of view that is anti-Trump. Some people, maybe the Times. And what the journal is saying correctly is that's not a valid way to write a critical review of the play. And they're absolutely correct about that. And I cannot avoid coming to the conclusion that that's exactly what the Times review is all about, because you can't match that review the time with that
with
play.
With what we saw.
Yeah. So that one's, if there's such a thing as theater malpractice, you know, criticism. In terms of criticism-wise, yeah. That would be the Times on that.
So I mean, we know the Times. Clearly, sometimes we're aware they're giving a positive review of something they want to
right.
like.
Right.
Okay.
And there are more innocent reasons for that. Yeah. There are more benign reasons. Sometimes they're encouraging a playwright. Sometimes they're encouraging a nonprofit theater. Whatever. And you have to go through that. You have to read the reviews with that in mind. And sometimes you have to read more than one review. But to favor a play because you're sympathetic with its political content is, to me, inexcusable. Unless you're going to identify that as part of the review.
Well, yeah, we were bamboozled.
We were bamboozled. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it's one thing to pay $15.
I don't mind supporting the theater. And it's a beautiful theater, and we'll probably be back.
Yes, we hope to go back.
Okay, we wanted to do a couple of follow-ups. And one was on the Met Museum.
Yeah, the Met Museum. So we had said before they're contemplating charging a fee to get in. Mm-hmm. And so the Times actually went around and interviewed people and said, would you pay to go in the Met? And the resounding answer pretty much is yes.
Yes.
I mean, basically, people pay to go in museums all over the world, and they say... And the biggest answer is, it's such an amazing collection, of course. I would pay to see it.
The answer is yes, but the answer that you got the yes to was the question being, we're interviewing people that we were going to photograph for the New York Times and ask them if they pay, and they will pay to go to a museum, should I put you down that you would pay? And the answer to that question is yes. So that's a little bit of a different question.
Well, there are people already going to the museum.
Yeah.
Okay, so they...
It's a skewed vision.
They love to go to the museum, and they will continue to pay if they have to.
Yeah, but look, that's where it's heading. So get your checkbook out of that. And the other follow-up we wanted to get to, because this is a story which hasn't received sufficient attention, is the proposal in the Swedish town that we described earlier that that workers receive a subsidized 1 hour a week for sex breaks. And that proposal was put to the local board, and it was supported in large part for several reasons. One is that there is a dwindling population there, and they thought it would help the dwindling population if people had more of an opportunity to engage in sexual activity. Also, the thought was that that would have strengthened romantic relationships. I'm reading now, benefited busy couples with children, and empowered women by giving them time to ensure that they were sexually satisfied. And yet, the captain's laughing.
Is that how we sell something these days? And say, and yes, it will empower women.
To be sexually satisfied. The last part's very important. But in any event, notwithstanding all those good things going for it, it was defeated. And why was it defeated? It was defeated because the point of view that if sexual intercourse was subsidized, then so should many other personal activities such as gardening or cleaning. And it's really hard to argue.
Would cleaning wouldn't empower women, though?
If they did it until they were satisfied.
There's been a lot of cleaning going on by women, and
they're not empowered.
They don't seem empowered enough. So.
Yeah. Well, there are other negative things about it that were pointed out in the negative vote. They felt that the measure could have stigmatized some employees, those who were single, for example, or who did not feel like having sex. As to the dwindling population point, the prevailing point of view was that was not the result of too little sexual activity, but because young people were leaving town. And the other problem...
I'm not even sure what that means.
They're leaving town because they don't have the 1 hour for the sexual activity. And the final point is...
So there is population, but they're just not there.
I don't know.
Got it.
The third point, the final point was that it might not be the correct measure anyway, according to one of the voters, because 1 hour for sex might not be enough time for women to switch gears and get in the mood. So, all coaching considerations, and the vote was negative. So
okay, just one more follow-up.
Yes, what's
because
that?
It is baseball season.
Yeah.
And what I neglected to mention, we talked before that the Egyptians, possibly invented baseball.
Yeah, definitely.
We know that Thutmose III was playing some kind of baseball-type game, right? I forgot to mention that they also had beer.
Did they? Oh, that's right, that they had beer.
They had beer. So just think of that.
They had
that
beer.
That tradition of beer and baseball goes back thousands of years, at least 3,000 years.
And the Mets are causing.
So it's a legitimate occupation in and of itself.
Okay. Well, speaking of sports, We have a special sports segment brought to you in large part by the famous Abuhoff cousins, who have something to say. Hi, we have a special segment today. We'll call it the cousins segment, although you might call it the sports segment also, because we have as special visitors today Sean and Ryan Abuhoff, who are about to embark on a trip in a Mazda 3 all the way from Pennsylvania to Florida. Much of it done today. And we are joined also by Granger Abuhoff, my oldest, and the three of them known colloquially as the cousins, although there are other cousins besides. But we wanted to take advantage of having all three together to cover a few subjects, particularly since the guys from Florida have a little different perspective on sports. Number one, they actually watched the Preakness yesterday, and they can give us an up-to-date report. Go ahead, guys.
Well, thank you for having us. First off, I'd just like to say that watching the Preakness was a little disheartening, to say the least. For one, the horse that won, Cloud Computing, ended up not running in the Kentucky Derby. The big thing about that is, I think in the last 33 years, only three horses have won the Preakness without running in the Kentucky Derby. You have anything to say on that, Sean?
Yeah, listen, he beat out the favorites. He came down to the end, and it brought up this big issue of whether horses should be held out, almost like draft players are staying out of bowl games for football. I mean, they rested the horse.
Well, you know, but it's right, but it's horses just plays out a little bit differently because, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, it's tough on these three-year-olds to do all the prep necessary to qualify for the Derby. And there are trainers are increasingly thinking of holding out the horses from the Derby because they don't think they're ready and they don't want to do the prep races. And that's what happened here, too. Now, before I forget, because I don't remember, what was the name of the horse that won the Derby?
It was Always Dreaming.
Always Dreaming. And if I, correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan in particular, is it not the case that you won money on Always Dreaming in the Derby?
Big winner over here.
Okay,
big
and winner. Is that not the reason that you're disappointed at the result in the Preakness?
You know, it's not that I'm disappointed in the horse. I'm more disappointed in myself.
All right, all right. Well, we're disappointed in you for other reasons, so that works out fine. All right, well, thanks for the Preakness update. We also want to take advantage of the cousins here from all over to talk about basketball, in particular the rivalry between the Miami Heat and the New York Knickerbockers, two franchises which have had comparable fortunes, but they seem to be heading in different directions. And I'll start with Granger, and I'll just give you the opportunity. You don't have to take it. Do you think the Knicks are better than the Heat?
No.
Okay, and I said, you guys agree with that too, right?
Yeah, we're on board with
but
that.
But why is, I'll start with, go back to Granger again. So you have this situation, you have these two coaches, they're both in their 70s, you have Phil Jackson, who's the GM of the Knicks, and you have Pat Riley, who I think is a godlike figure in Miami. I don't know what his official title is. He's running the show. Why is it that Pat Riley should have more success in Miami than Jackson's having in New York?
I think Pat Riley has more of his personal success and identity invested in being the GM versus, I think that Phil Jackson still thinks, I'm a coach and now I'm just cashing in. You know, Riley develops these players in the D-League. He goes, he finds new players. He gets these guys like Hassan Whiteside who are out of the league. He gets free agents to come. Phil Jackson's attitude is, I'm a big deal. Come to me.
All right. Well, so you guys are a little closer to it, Sean and Ryan. But do you agree with that assessment? You're Riley fans?
I mean, it's a system that he's created that they are looking for players that they don't necessarily have to spend the top money for. They're bringing in players that are a little forgotten, and they find roles for them, and they become bigger than their position, than the role that they're brought in for.
Well, that, you got to credit the GM. So you're a Riley fan also?
I'm a Riley fan. I think his actual title on top of GM is the president of basketball operations for the Miami Heat. What I would say with that would be he's given opportunity that Phil Jackson isn't given. And what I mean by that is not only from picks, but trading and discussing with actual players and the talent. And he comes in and he's able to talk to them and bring them in and sell them not only on the area, but on the drive and the actual culture that is Miami All Heat right. basketball. Wait,
you also alluded to something there, which is that Aronson will let him do what he wants versus everyone kind of thinks Dolan ruins everything.
Are Aronson's the owner of the Heat?
Aronson owns the Heat, and Mickey Aronson seems to do a good job. Dolan seems to know just enough about basketball that he likes to ruin things a little bit.
Well, I don't know. It's not trying to ruin anything, but it's a little different situation. But let me go to something else, though, which I think is kind of interesting. Granger mentioned that before, which is that are the Heat really helping themselves? Because isn't there a trap in the NBA that you become a 500 team and you're kind of floating, but you're not able to get that super high draft choice and you're not able to vault yourself into the championship round? Is there something to that?
Yeah, definitely. But I think that there's a very small group of contenders in the NBA in general. And I think the Heat are kind of stuck. At the beginning of the year, they thought maybe things aren't starting well, we'll tank. But the truth is that Spoelstra and Riley just don't like to lose.
Spoelstra's the coach.
Spoelstra's the coach. And they got used to winning during the Big Three era. And they had a lot of success before that, even with Alonzo and Shaq. And they can't stomach the losing.
Okay. Well, that's clear, but so is this a championship team in the next few years, the Miami Heat?
Well, that's the question. I mean, they are, if they can bring in a big name signing, yes, they have the role players now to fit the positions to help that player out, but they just don't have that player.
And Ryan, who are they going after?
From local sources, we hear that they're going after Gordon Hayward of the Utah Jazz, which I do like as a player. I think he's very versatile, and he does play according to what the Heat require and request from their players, which is heart and determination.
But isn't he just a more expensive version of decent players they already have?
Well, yeah. In comparison, our biggest draft prospect who's in that position is Justice Winslow, who just had an injury last year. So there is no telling whether he's going to bounce back.
Yeah, but I would also say, we'll move on in a second, I think Gordon's a better shooter than Justin Winslow, don't you think?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, Hayward's just a better three-point shooter. Let me just go to, as long as we're on the subject of coaching and the significance of coaching. It was a big story having to do with the Golden State Warriors. Steve Kerr is not coaching. He's not coaching because of back pain. And I have to tell you, my initial reaction in hearing this story, and I think a lot of people were stunned, including me, is how bad did your back have to be that you can't sit on the sidelines and coach the game? I mean, and I'm not by any means faulting the guy. I mean, he has serious back problems. And we caught an article, I think it was in a journal recently, about his back surgery, but I know Granger mentioned it's been talked about quite a bit, that what basically happened is he had an unsuccessful operation. I mean, maybe you want to elaborate on that.
Yeah, anyone who asks, Steve Kerr will tell them, don't get back surgery. And it's because his experience was that he's a professional athlete, in great health, trouble with his back, herniated disc, and now he's unable to sit through a whole basketball game, sometimes unable to walk. And it's really strange because I've never heard of this before. Phil Jackson had a back injury that made him get an orthopedic chair. I think that it's unprecedented to see a coach have to miss games for injury.
Yeah, I mean, and you were saying, Sean, it's a herniated disc, yes. Right? What the article says is that usually, number one, there's some debate as to when you should have surgery for a herniated disc. So it's a little bit of a mystery. But even so, when you have the surgery, it shouldn't be harmful. And that's what happened here.
If I could touch on one thing, and this goes back to the NBA culture, this is the persona that is Kerr. And what I mean by that is, if we look at him from a coaching standpoint, the coach that is Kerr, he had to sit out a lot of games this year, but did their record, change, or did they lose enough games with him out? And according to me, I believe that it didn't affect the team as much as I thought it would. And I think that's a cause for alarm.
Well, why is it a cause for alarm?
Well, I think it's for how much they're paying him, the necessity might not be there.
They're doing fine. When you win a championship, you're okay, you overpay a few people.
Look, it's a fair question. You can sit out, the longer a coach sits out and the team continues to succeed, people are going to ask questions how necessary the coach are. On the other hand, you're still reading articles today as the reason that they're succeeding is because of what he set up before he got hurt. And you can debate that back and forth. But let me get to the question that really matters here. I should say, just to finish the point of the Steve Kerr thing, to finish the controversy, the real problem right now in California is for the orthopedic surgeons in California, because they're saying that only in 5% of procedures you see anything like
the effects that Steve Kerr is suffering. And yet because he is making the rounds in terms of interviews or whatever and saying to people, don't get back surgery, people are doubting what they're able to do for their patients.
And that's a big deal. He's a public figure. I mean, a lot of people are going to look to it and give that more weight than just a normal study or just anybody off the street.
Right. So it must be frustrating if you're a doctor and you feel you've got something to offer, but people aren't doing it because Steve Kerr can't walk. But it's the reality. But let me get to the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is, who's going to win the NBA title? So here's your chance. Ryan cannot contain himself. He's going to tell us who's going to win the NBA title.
I'm not going to choose a team. I'm going to choose a person, and that's LeBron James.
All right. So for those of us
who... I think you have to choose a team.
Those of us who are in the know, LeBron James plays for the Cleveland Cavaliers. So that's one for the Cavaliers. Granger, who do you think?
The Warriors. Kevin Durant's too much. Warriors this year.
I say Golden State's too much. You, at any one time, they can rest people and still put on a first-place team, so...
Well, I'm not sure myself, but I'm inclined to pick against Ryan.
Really?
That's sort of the way I roll.
Usually that's a good decision.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you didn't have the winner of the Preakness, right?
Oh, man. Just drive it home. Drive it all home.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for right now. These guys got to head for the road. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. So
and
we're back.
Back.
And there were some audiobooks that you were going to tell us about.
Yeah, so it's that time of year where you're going on long trips, etc. So it's good to know, good to have an idea of what kind of audiobooks are available. And in the Times Review, book review this week, there are a couple mentioned that get a big thumbs up. And one of them is Sherlock Holmes. 63 Hours, The Complete Sherlock Holmes, by Arthur Conan Doyle. And it's narrated by Stephen Fry. Now, you know Stephen Fry, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Well, listen, Jeeves and Worcester.
One of Dan's favorites.
Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. Television does not get better than that.
Yeah. Apparently they met in college.
Yeah.
And so there is that. And, you know, and he's Fry's a director, a writer, a comedian. He's had shows. He's been in shows. He's had... shows on the BBC, etc.
Right.
So
he's been on Broadway with the Oscar Wilde.
So apparently, and of course, it's easy to understand. We can't get enough of Holmes because he kind of figures everything out. He uses scientific method to make sense of the chaos that is life and crime.
Well, I think Stephen Fry would be a good match for Holmes.
And that's what the Times says. The pairing of Fry and Holmes is a bit of a marriage made in heaven. In Britain, he is himself almost as much a national treasure, that is to say Fry, as Holmes. A public figure whose every utterance is avidly reported and disseminated, blah, 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 blah. And his skill in phrasing and articulation over the whole 60-plus hours is beyond praise. There are other complete recorded Holmeses, but none sustains the course so buoyantly and none with the added pleasure of the reader's pithy commentary.
Oh, that's high praise.
On each book.
That's high praise.
So look for that if you need to drive somewhere for 63 hours.
Yeah,
or to just entertain. You know, when you're not listening to Tamsin and Dan, read the paper.
Exactly.
You might want to tune into that. The other one is one I'm currently listening to that I said I was going to listen to or read, and that is The North Mythology, written and read by Neil Gaiman. And
He reads it?
He reads it.
How is he as a reader?
He's fantastic.
Really?
Actually, yes.
You know, this is kind of annoying. Everything this guy does, everybody's praising to this guy.
And the review starts out, admit it, wouldn't you love to have Neil Gaiman come to your home and read stories to you?
I can see where this is going. Yeah,
I would.
Oh, man.
And
this is off-putting there.
And this reviewer, who's a woman, actually says, she is totally, she thought her bedroom might explode into Valhalla.
Okay.
Honestly, she says, I may have to order a breastplate of some sort.
Oh my God, Tamsin.
And it starts out.
Is it safe to drive while you're reading something like that?
Pretty well. Of course, I'm often in traffic, so there's not much skill involved.
Yeah.
Tells the story of Odin's spear and arm cuff, Thor's hammer.
Yeah, I get where this is going.
And all about Loki and all the crazy things Loki does. So what's interesting here is that Antipodes was nominally about storytelling.
Yeah, anomaly would be the good word.
And the stories, none of them were very compelling. Yeah. You know, when somebody, you know, reaches for part of the story being about people with penises coming out of their foreheads, that we're really reaching here.
Really? Okay? Is that reaching, you think? Thanks for reminding me.
But Gaiman is a supreme storyteller.
All right.
I was only marginally interested in North mythology, but the way he tells it, it really is very accessible, very modern, and he is a great enthusiast of the tradition of storytelling as a vital art.
I'm sold. We're going to have to spend a lot of time in the car.
Yeah.
Speaking of cars, in the area of scientific developments, the Times had an interesting article about a technology which I didn't know existed, or at least was as far along apparently it is, and that is clean, quiet hydrogen cars.
See, that sounds a little scary.
No. There's nothing.
Doesn't hydrogen like blow things up?
Yes, gasoline is not the greatest thing either. That's not the point. The point is that it's a hydrogen-powered car, and it is the cleanest possible burning fuel. It just emits some water vapors. It's based on a combination of oxygen and hydrogen and oxygen. The two elements bond, create an electric charge. You stack a few hundred cells together, and they generate enough electricity to power a car motor. And
easy peasy.
That would be the scientific term, yes. And it's fantastic. It solves a lot of problems that the battery-powered cars have not been able to solve. For example, the range of the car in terms of the fuel in the tank, 366 miles. By comparison, the Chevy Bolt, which goes about as far as a hybrid car goes now, 238 miles. It looks a lot like, dare I say it, the future. I mean, the economics aren't quite there, but they're getting there. And it's subsidized by the government in terms of your leasing cars and buying cars. But then again, so are hybrid cars and other electric cars.
So there
cars.
Are these cars on the road?
They are where else? In California. They sell them and drive them in California, in La La Land. And the challenge, which I think can be overcome, is you need the hydrogen fueling stations.
Okay.
And there are 30-some-odd hydrogen fueling stations already in California. It's just a matter of time. They're going to get them in the Northeast. That's the next target. And so before you invest all your money in what I will call yesterday's technology, such as the existing electric cars and hybrid cars, check out hydrogen cars, because they may well be the future, and it's pretty exciting.
So, I smell, post-retirement venture here, okay?
Yeah, I don't know.
All right. Abuhoff hydrogen stops.
Yeah, that could be the business we should get in. We'll talk about that after.
We'll work on that.
Yes, exactly. But here's a business I wouldn't be so eager to jump in, although it's awfully profitable, and that is what you see increasingly are ads for extremely narrowly focused conditions that just a few people might have, or maybe they
like
don't
ED?
Even have. No, not like ED, Timson. That's a serious medical condition.
All
I'm
right.
talking about something else, okay?
All right.
This is something called pseudo-bulbar effect, or PBA, a neurological condition characterized by inappropriate, uncontrolled outbursts of laughing or crying. Now, I'm not here to say that this is not a real disease.
Right.
But here's the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is that there are now ads on television, as the Times writes about here, in which Danny Glover, the famous actor, illustrates what it is to have extreme laughing and extreme crying. The point being that if you laugh a lot and cry a lot, you don't necessarily have a disease.
Right.
As the article points
out. Well, you know how it is. You read any symptoms, symptoms, and you end up saying, I got that.
And
I must have that.
Right. But the problem is this. The ads work. Their sales rose from $37 million in 2012 to $218 million last year. And why? Because it's $800 a month for this medication. And the worry, of course, is, there are a lot of people, they're just what you would call emotional. And
would a responsible doctor prescribe that?
There's a concern that it is overprescribed. And you can certainly see where people would react to the ad and call their doctor and say, this is the thing I need. I'm crying too much. I'm laughing too much. And, one doctor says, look, I'm the kind of person who gets teary-eyed at AT&T ads. I'm just like that. And would not want to take a medicine to address that condition. I think it really is on the borderline, but the truth is, a lot of the pharmaceuticals that you see advertised, especially late at night, are open to the same criticism. All right, so you had, you were going to talk about the King Arthur legend.
First of all, we have to acknowledge, we haven't seen the King Arthur movie.
And I think we're probably not going to.
Well, because nobody else is. Yes. So it's not going to be around long enough for us to wander down to the local cinema and see it. But there's a little article in the, what newspaper is this, the Wall Street Journal?
Yes.
Kind of talking about the Arthurian legend, which was a fascination of mine growing up. I guess it was first started with musical Camelot.
Right.
Probably. And they say one of the problems with the movie itself might be is this attempt to rewrite Arthur's character and story to make him seem more down to earth and less like the extraordinarily virtuous leader of legend. Mm-hmm. And of course, what's interesting about this, although they say, you know, to some extent may have been based by a real character, and, you know, acknowledge that Arthur is real in the sense of, in a psychological sense, the epitome of the flawed hero, the article says, the great man whose unwavering belief in his own righteousness leads to fatal mistakes. Okay, but, you know, truth be told, he was to some extent designed by an Oxford cleric in 1136, Geoffrey of Monmouth. And he was a kind of a composite character. He was fake. It was a work of fake history.
Yes.
Put together, you know, a little bit of a 5th century military commander who drove the Romans out of Eastern France. You know, a couple of different characters to make this story. And people loved it almost immediately. Mm-hmm. There was a real taste during this period for a literary tradition of chivalry and courtly love. Okay, so we're talking about the 12th century. I need to mention here, I don't know if you realize this, but this whole knights on horseback, courtly love, rescuing damsels in distress, it actually comes from Persia. It comes from also the Middle East. It's from stories that the supposedly the Crusaders brought back with them. So all those Renaissance fairs, it's all based on traditions from rather far away. Anyway, I mean, the most popular version was actually Le Morte d'Arthur, written by Thomas Malory, who was a real bad boy and was was a violent thief, extortionist, accused rapist, and while he's in jail as a political prisoner, he spends his time imagining a once and future England full of valor and nobility. So, you know, this tradition is strong, and of course goes back to Camelot. And we think of Jackie Kennedy saying, "There will never be another Camelot." And of course, we all knew what she meant. Nobody seems to know, this reviewer says, what King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, was supposed to mean, if anything. And that's a tragedy.
Yeah.
Okay. So, talking about superstars, and King Arthur, definitely a superstar.
Yeah.
There was a little, there's a column in the Metropolitan section of the New York Times called FYI, where people write in and ask questions, and the Times scurries about to find the answers, whatever they are. And this week's question was about, there were, you know, in 1964 when the Beatles arrived at Kennedy Airport, there were 3,000 fans. But isn't it true that this was small compared to the welcome given an opera star who visited 114 years earlier?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes. That opera star was Jenny Lind.
I didn't know Jenny Lind was an opera star.
Yes, she was an opera star. She was born in 1820. Mm-hmm. And she's Swedish, and she's a huge sensation. Mm-hmm. Beginning when she's about 18, she retires when she's 29.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but after she retires, she makes a deal with P.T. Barnum. P.T. Barnum's never even heard her.
Mm-hmm.
He's clueless, but she's a sensation.
Mm-hmm.
And he signs her up. She does 95 performances all over the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
In 1849,
1850. Mm-hmm.
And she donates most, maybe even all, her fees to charity,
mm-hmm.
actually. And Barnum makes millions, functional equivalent to millions of dollars at that time. And she was a super de-duper star. All kinds of tchotchkes,
mm-hmm.
All kinds of souvenir tchotchkes. There's a bed named after her. I mean, I grew up sleeping in a Jenny Lind bed, and they still make the Jenny Lind style bed today, and I'm sure pretty much no one who buys it knows who the heck Jenny Lind was. And, she is the claim to fame of various little spots all over the United States where in 1849 she stopped and spent the night.
Well, that's, listen, when we went to school, we learned about Jenny Lind.
Oh, that's perhaps, funny, because I'm sure nobody...
Not anymore.
And actually, I should mention, and back to Nancy Ferguson, who went to Smith in Northampton.
Yeah.
Jenny Lind apparently proclaimed Northampton the a little bit of paradise in America.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. See, I hadn't seen Kingston. But yeah, okay. I'll buy that. Okay, so... in your discussion of Jenny Lind, you mentioned she was compared to rock stars, and I think our final piece will be about a book, which is a collection of reviews of what we in modern times consider rock stars, and that would be contemporary criticism of rock music over the last 40, 50 years, in a book called Shake It Up, which is edited by Jonathan Lethem and Kevin Detmar. And in reviewing the book, Dwight Garner, the reviewer of the Times, helpfully sets out a test at the very beginning to measure whether you might be interested. And the test really is focused on Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. And he says there are three categories of reaction to that. One is that this is a coup for sanity and wit. Two, Dylan is a genius, but what he makes isn't literature. And three, this is a spiritual disaster. So if you are in category three, the book is not for you. If you're in category two, maybe, borderline.
Maybe,
But category one, you're in. And it's kind of interesting because he makes the point, the editors made the point, that one of the reasons that rock criticism was as popular as it was and so prevalent in the 60s, 70s, and so on, was that it appeared in liner notes. There was a lot of writing about rock music in liner notes. And as you remember, Tamsin, liner notes were the notes that appeared on the back of an LP.
On the LP cover.
On the LP cover, exactly right. And the reason that you had such extensive notes was, for the most obvious reason...
Big!
Right, the LPs were big. There was a lot of space, a lot of space to write. And they took advantage of that. Now the CDs... and of course, music streaming, not so much.
Right.
So you
so
have.
You miss that.
Yeah, you miss that. You miss a lot of criticism and a lot of writing about music that took place in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And there are a couple of examples given here by the reviewer, and it gives you a sense of what's in the book. So there's a discussion of some. One piece was about the Doors, and they talk about the fact that the Doors actually took their name from Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World. He had a phrase, Doors of Perception. Well, in this reviewer's sense, that was a geeky 2LA pottery glazer kind of uncool idea, which is probably an interesting way to write, and fairly sad, you know, it gets at the Doors a little bit. There's a an observation in a Robert Christgau piece on Prince, and he makes the observation, quote, that Mick Jagger should fold up his penis and go home, which is,
he's done. He's toast.
He's toast. I like to think that's what it means, but evocative nevertheless.
Okay.
And finally, in a piece about Elvis by a fellow named Lester Bangs, says the following. He says, I can guarantee you one thing. We will never again agree on anything as we agreed on Elvis. So I won't bother saying goodbye to his corpse. I will say goodbye to you. So that's a book you might be interested in. As for us, it's time for us to fold it up and go home. Thanks for listening to Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Good night.